Arabic is the official language of more than 27 countries, and there are more than 400 million speakers of the language worldwide. Yet in the US, for example, less than 1% of students study Arabic. Studies have shown that those who speak a second language not only earn more, but are in higher level positions than their monolingual counterparts. And there's no shortage of studies that point to the benefits of students at the K-12 level learning a new language. The National Research Council in 2007 found that children who study a foreign language show greater cognitive development in areas such as mental flexibility, creativity, and higher order thinking skills. Qatar Foundation International inspires meaningful connections to the Arab world by creating a global community of diverse learners and educators, connecting them through effective and collaborative learning environments inside and outside the classroom. Qatar Foundation International builds bridges across cultures by increasing the number of K-12 students in the Americas and the United Kingdom with a good knowledge and understanding of Arabic language and culture by increasing the number and quality of Arabic programs in state and public charter schools in the United States and other countries. Qatar Foundation International supports the teaching of the Arabic language through grant giving and programming activities while increasing and professionalizing the supply of highly qualified teachers of Arabic, thus raising the visibility of a growing profession through grants, professional development, and free online resources. For more information on free teaching materials and available grants, please go to qfi.org and ispeakarabic.com. And now, a quick message from our friends at iClassics Education. iClassics Education is a new program based on the award-winning iClassics immersive reading app collection, an indie startup based in Barcelona. Created by a team of educators, developers, and designers, it provides a truly unique and high-quality medium to engage students with literature. The program includes an analytics platform enabling teachers to monitor student progress, iClassics specific teacher resources for each app, unlimited access to the entire iClassics app collection, and maintenance and updates. For more information on engaging students with literature and to see what they're up to, visit iClassicsCollection.com/en/education. You can also sign up for a free account at iClassicsEDU.com. Hello everyone, and welcome to this fifth part of the ASU GSV Summit series of 10 episodes on the EdTech podcast. My name is Sophie Bailey and you are very welcome. I hope that wherever you listen to this, the sun is shining, whether you're on the underground, driving to work or walking your dogs. This week we're getting into the many-headed beast of educational reform. Educational reform can mean many things to many people, but essentially focuses on changing public education for the better. For example, at the time of recording these interviews, the incoming 11th Educational Secretary in the US, Betsy DeVos, was advocating for more choice in school options, an approach rejected by critics for only favouring those who are able to exercise such choice due to economic and social mobility and freedom. During her keynote, DeVos stated,
"Our education delivery methods should then be as diverse as the kids they serve, instead of our habit of forcing them into a one-size-fits-all system or model. Traditional, charter, private, virtual, and other delivery methods not yet developed, all would be treated as viable options so long as they met the needs of their students."
To a choice audience of educational technology proponents, DeVos gave a confident endorsement of EdTech, something we are yet to see explicitly from the UK government, stating,
"But I'm pretty confident that we have not yet realized the full range of technology's power and ability to help students learn."
She also vowed to cut bureaucracy to unleash these benefits. In other words, to quote, "move the federal government out of the way so you can do your job." End quote. In this episode, we spend time looking at the various efforts of educational reform across the US and how these compare internationally, including focus on literacy, adult education, and higher education. How is educational reform coordinated across multiple states in the US? How can the tide of adult literacy be turned? And how can the financial structures of higher ed be challenged to increase access? All this and more in our interviews with this week's guests. You'll hear from Lizette Gonzalez-Reynolds, Vice President of Policy at Excel in Ed, Heather Hulls, Deputy Director on the Post-Secondary Success Team with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Hutton Hinson Higgins, Senior Director, Development and Strategic Alliances at the Barbara Bush Foundation for Family Literacy. And what's more, you should also check out additional educational reform content from the ASU GSV Summit team, including the Betsy DeVos keynote in full, in our show notes, weekly email, or via the ASU GSV Summit website, asugsvsummit.com, where the whole series is listed. A big shout out to the ASU GSV Summit, Qatar Foundation International, and the iClassics Collection for sponsoring this week's episode. And don't forget, if you're enjoying the series, to drop us a review on iTunes. Okay, here we go, episode 84, and let us know what you think via Twitter at podcastedtech and at ASU GSV Summit. Have a great week. Yay! I'm surviving the jet lag and I'm here with Lizette Gonzalez-Reynolds, who is Vice President of Policy at Excel in Ed. So welcome, Lizette.
Thank you.
So just for those people listening, are you able to kind of talk to me a little bit about Excel in Ed when you joined as VP of Policy? And as I understand it, the mission to sort of bring together the educational reform advocates out there and what they're doing.
Right. So the formal name is the Foundation for Excellence in Education, and it's the Education Foundation founded by Governor Jeb Bush. So after he left the governorship, he created this foundation to continue the education reforms that had been implemented in the state of Florida. And so as his foundation continued to provide us technical assistance to the state policymakers, other states became interested in the same types of reforms. And those reforms are kind of in these three buckets. So you've got accountability and assessment, you have school choice, and then you have innovation, which includes much of the ed tech blended kind of conversations, competency-based education, college career pathways, which is kind of really what's been at the cutting edge right now and what a lot of people are talking about here today.
Yeah, I mean, just on that, I know that this morning there was the Foundation for Blended Learning had
yes,
a drink,
yeah.
which I didn't get to. And then this morning I attended an initiative which was a collaboration between Arizona State University and the Asia Society on competency. And they're rolling out a program for schools to kind of pick up to make their students sort of global citizens. Mm-hmm. So how do you go about sort of then thinking about implementing that in policy? Because I think that's crucial, because there's so much good stuff out there, but if it's not put into policy, then it doesn't become that priority for people who are judged on that criteria.
Well, so for many years, I'd also worked for the state of Texas. I was chief deputy commissioner there. And so what I saw and why policy is so important is people tend to sell programs. They sell programs, then they get a little bit of a catch, and then they never sustain, they never scale, because there's no policy basis for the actual programs. So that's why our organization is so strong in the policy area, because we know that you've got to create that backbone for which programs can be developed and then thrive and survive. But policy is also hard. It's not easy. I can't believe I'm going to say this, but it's, as my CEO likes to use, as well as my director of competency-based education, it's the broccoli, right? Not everybody wants to eat the broccoli. You know, they all want the candy and the cheese.
So, I mean, that was a phrase on this panel I moderated on Monday about, yeah. like, you know, chocolate-covered broccoli. So then how do you make it, how do you make it palatable in that way then?
Right. And that's the hard part. So we have worked with states to develop policies in these areas. Some have sustained, some have backed away. My state of Texas, had a very strong backbone in accountability and assessment, has since kind of turned back the clock, in a sense, because it has become so difficult, because there hasn't been the right communication about why the policy was so important. And why is the policy important? Because it ensures that all kids are receiving the same level of education, regardless of their backgrounds, their socioeconomic status, or where they came from. Right? We're really making sure that the system is accountable for all their learning. But that's hard for people, because sometimes it tends to create that glass ceiling, and then kids that could crash through it are kind of held down because everybody's trying to support the kids that need the most support. So, and so, yeah, so just kind of in working that always remains our foundation, though. At the end of the day, no matter what ed tech programs or what, if you decide to do a personalized learning system of education and learning and teaching, you've got to make sure that there's a way to measure whether or not the kids are learning. Otherwise, it's 1,000 flowers blooming, and then you're going to have a bunch of weeds growing through all that. And these kids are going to fall through the cracks.
And so were you at the Jefferson Education Symposium last week? Did you hear about that? It's like an efficacy event. It's exactly what you were talking about. That's why I wondered if you might be there. But I suppose what's really interesting as well is, you know, education is such a political issue. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I had a quick look at your donors. So you've got everyone from Bill and Melinda Gates to the Dick and Betsy DeVos Foundation. So, you know, it's sort of not sort of partisan politics, right, if you will. So
many of these funders fund us for their specific priorities.
Yeah.
And so like with the DeVos Foundation, they're very focused on the choice area. Of course, that's different now because she's now Secretary of Education. But the Bloomberg philanthropies support us in accountability and really helping support particular states where they have interest. And so same thing with Walton, right? They're very supportive of charter schools. And so part of the work is really being able to stay true to ourselves, mm-hmm, and to help states implement these policies. And then these funders just help us enable those states to do that, whether it's developing the policy, actually advocating and passing the policy. And that's the separate division from me. That's we have an advocacy division, and I'm the policy division. And then it's implementation. And then sustaining, right? How do we continue to work with our state leadership, our state policymakers, to make sure that the policy continues to produce the kinds of outcomes we want for kids? But if the policy is going to get in the way of outcomes and of student achievement, then we need to have different conversations about how do we do this better? And if not, then maybe the policy is not so great anymore.
And was it your website where I saw it's kind of, you know, all the states, and then you can kind of zoom in, see what policies are being developed, so people can get a sense of what's happening where, and, you know, what's kind of ideas are spreading? And
yes, but our website is, it should be, we should have an under construction. And that's really that's part of the goal of this, of our revamped website, is really to help stakeholders, parents, policymakers, business leaders look and see where these policies are making a positive impact for kids and what's happening. You know, I mean, we'd like to dig it deeper. What's really happening? How are they doing that? Who is the leadership, and why do they keep, what is their interest? Why do they do this? And many times it's because they're all about the kids first before the adults. And that's where we feel the most strongly, is that our focuses have to be on the kids and their parents and how we build systems around their needs. And then the adults in the system should then be held accountable for how they achieve.
So, yeah, one of my questions was, obviously the EdTech podcast thinks about innovation and that end of things. So, and you may have an opinion on this or not, but what's holding the digital or learning revolution back? So if you think about reform, lots of those issues that we talk about on the podcast have been in discussion for like decades. So what do you think are some of the sticking points there?
Oh, this is a hard one without getting in trouble. But I do think while there are many innovators existing in our public school system and outside our public school system, it's still a system that hasn't changed in I don't know how many years, right? I mean, it's very stagnant. It doesn't tend to be dynamic. And part of it too is the politics and the fear of what the digital age is going to bring to our school, you know, to bring to our schools. And so we have to help the education community understand this digital learning isn't to replace the teachers. It's not to replace the leadership, because those kids still need that support and that level of learning from their instructors.
And part of that as well is like pastoral care. So for some people, you know, it's that experience of positive relationships as well. So you can't really replace that with technology.
Yeah. So yesterday I visited School Innovations Early College High School here in Salt Lake City. Amazing leader in the principal, Kenneth Grover. And he talked about how he created a system around where they really trust the kids. He doesn't make his teachers worry about attendance or about behavior issues, because the teachers are there to help teach the kids and then to help bring in this blended learning environment, the support and structures they need so that they can be successful in their learning and achieving their credits towards their high school diploma, in many cases towards their associate's degrees. So it's an amazing way of thinking differently about what your schools really need to look like and how you need to empower the kids and trust them in many cases to learn And so, you know, it was because we had a couple of tour guides with us, you know, some students, and both of them said, you know, we didn't really know what to do. You know, we sat down and they wanted us to learn, but we were kind of fish out of water, and it's kind of a learning opportunity. But one girl, she's like, I kept raising my hand to go to the bathroom. And they're like, you don't have to raise your hand.
Just go. Yeah.
Right. And
it's a really good point, because we kind of infantilize a lot, I think, within the school environment. You know, in Sweden, they allow students to download anything they want onto their laptops. They just trust them. You know, they teach them about which things might be at risk, and then they just kind of trust them to get on with it. So they don't have all this kind of restrictions on stuff. So interesting, different cultures. So if you could implement one policy across the US, what would it be?
I think the most critical policy that all our schools need to continue to maintain and sustain is ensuring accountability for every student's learning. I mean, that's the bottom line. We all as adults need to be held accountable for the impact that we're making on our students, because they're our future. They're our economic future, and they're our, you know, a political future. We need to be able to adapt.
And then how did you get into your role, and what was your kind of learning curve and career path?
Well, I graduated a political science degree, and I was 30 minutes north of Austin, Texas, at a small liberal arts university. And I was like, I want to be a lobbyist. So I went down with my bachelor's in political science and found a job for $5, basically being a Girl Friday for a lobbyyist. But then I worked for the chamber then, and then I had my opportunity to work for a state senator. And it just so happened, it was in 1995 when Governor George Bush became governor, and his main priority, his main initiative was, and this is George W. Bush, not Governor Jeb Bush, was education. And so they basically revamped the education code. I just so happened to be the aide on the education committee to the state senator, Teal Bivens. And that just really kind of embarked me on education policy. I worked for Governor George Bush, did a lot. And of course, because his priorities were education, I did a lot of education policy. Went to DC, worked a couple of years there, worked for Margaret Spellings, Rod Page, and then worked at the state of Texas for about 7 years in the state agency. And just blessed through my contacts and my opportunities that were given to me by my commissioners of education to go out and connect with the national organizations is how I ran into the foundation and Patricia Levesque of the foundation, and just was lucky enough to be, you know, asked to apply for this job. And so that's how I am today.
And how do you relax? Like, what kind of excites you as a person as well?
I like to lift weights.
Oh, really? Wow. You do look pretty trim.
I just work on that body fat, you know. So I started off just a small little gym. It was built out of a body shop or whatever, and started kind of with the CrossFit type stuff, but then really got bit by the weightlifting bug. And
wowzers.
I really love it. Yeah.
Yeah. And if people are listening in and they'd like to connect with you either on weightlifting or policy, probably more probably, how can they go about doing that?
So you can email me at lizzett@xlned.org.
Excellent. And are you a Twitter fan? Are you on Twitter? Or
I
so
am.
Much?
I believe it's at Lizette54.
Okay.
I don't know. You can find, I'm sure if you did a search, you can find it. I'm on LinkedIn.
I guess if people are listening, they're going to South by Southwest EDU next year.
That's right.
They'll be able to find you there.
Oh yeah, I'll be there.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Lizette. I'm delighted to be here with Heather Hiles, who's Deputy Director on the Post-Secondary Success Team with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So welcome.
Thank you.
So Heather, if I've done my homework quickly, you've raised $12 million in capital, built and sold edtech companies, and got 4,000 workers off of welfare and into jobs. So
actually, it's 11,000.
11,000.
I don't know where 4,000 comes from. But
goodness, I'm sorry.
No problem.
But I still think it sounds pretty stupendously successful. So congratulations on all of that.
Thank you.
Now you're at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So what's that like?
What's that like?
Yeah.
It's very different from starting up organizations because it's a very large, well-developed organization. I find that the position that I have is full of opportunity. So I find that very inspiring. And it's like amazing when I get to interact with Bill or Melinda Gates.
Yeah, that's quite a unique opportunity, I would have thought.
Yeah.
So when did you join the foundation?
About 8 months ago.
Okay. And so in terms of your key objectives there, what keeps you up at night and what are you excited about as well?
Well, we have a mission in the post-secondary team of trying to help 11 million people who otherwise will not be prepared for knowledge-based economy jobs, complete them by the year 2025. And so that is a really big goal. And I like big goals. So that's wonderful. I think about 4.5 million of those 11 million will be people who we will be able to help complete college that they start. And then the rest, we're going to need to find other ways to prepare them for the knowledge-based economy jobs.
That got me thinking. So post-secondary success, so it's not just higher education, it's colleges, it's boot camps. Is that right?
Or post-secondary is what we mean is after what we call K-12.
Yeah.
So it is anything that you would do after high school. And so most of that, and what we have done traditionally, is invest in more people being more successful in completing faster in better ways through college or university.
Yeah.
But you'll see the trend of new kinds of training that prepare people for jobs also really working for that workforce.
Definitely. I mean, we have this discussion back home around, you know, there's been that kind of traditional path of, you know, going to school, going to university, but actually there's so much alternative routes in terms of whether that's apprenticeships or boot camps or coding or whatever it is, or more vocational stuff. And I think previously that's had a bad name, and now people are becoming a bit more sophisticated about the fact that there's such a multitude of opportunities out there, and it's not just about going to university, and it doesn't suit everyone either.
Right, that's right.
On that note, is the current higher education system broken, and how could it be improved?
Oh, yeah. So that was the other part that I was going to talk about, is that there's a dysfunctional marketplace in the education space, at least in the U.S. And so while my direct portfolio is called Solutions, which means I am trying to develop and evolve different supply-side solutions like advising and digital learning and developmental education and financial aid and work study. I'm trying to build solutions that help our students. There is a lot of support that needs to be provided to institutions to be better consumers of the supply that's out there and to be better users of the solutions that are available to them. And then there's a lot of glue that we could provide to help make the marketplace work more efficiently. So we look for opportunities to do that as well.
Do you know Malcolm Gladwell?
Yes.
Yeah. And have you ever listened to his podcast?
Yes.
So, I mean, I remember driving down to Cornwall once and listening to about 8 hours of his podcast. And one was on his very evident anger on the system. So if you think about the Ivy League universities and perhaps, you know, and it does sort of price people out as well. So I just wondered about what's the kind of short-term solution and how do we go about changing some of that? Because the finance behind it and the student debt is kind of breathtaking as well.
Yes. So the financing in particular is really disheartening because we have lots of people who have taken on much more debt than they can ever repay without even understanding the implications of the debt. And unlike other credit card debt, you can't file bankruptcy in this country and absolve yourself of it. So it stays with you forever, no matter what. So we have a whole generation of people who are attending institutions, many of them not graduating, but then being saddled with debt that just kind of kills a lot of their future prospects and opportunities. And so it's not just about maybe they don't have the skills now or the credentials to get the job, but because of the debt, they're also not buying homes, they're not having children, they're not getting married. So a lot of things that they're missing out on. And so this is potentially a threat to our economy to have potentially such defaults in the billions and billions of dollars. So I think we've got to really think creatively and find new strategies for getting consumers more informed about what kind of debt they're taking on and for what kind of potential return. And then B, I think we need to find other ways of structuring loans and helping people finance reasonable amounts of debt for relative to what they're getting out of their experience, their training or their educational experiences.
Yeah. So at home we have, you know, you have a student loan and then when you start earning, you pay as a percentage of your earnings.
Yeah. That's something that we're looking at in this country and we call them income sharing agreements, but they have not been well demonstrated yet. There's like one public institution that's doing it right now. And they also don't have any kind of regulations or guardrails set on them yet. So we still in this country have a long way to go to figuring out how to do that. But I think that that at least makes a tighter correlation between a student and the return that they are actually receiving on their education as measured by what kind of salary they make on the other side.
We may look back at this and just think, you know, it was a bit of a sham. Like, you know, if you're paying or becoming indebted to such value and, you know, you can't get a job at the end of it, it's kind of crazy.
Oh, I mean, I've got a personal story on that account. My brother-in-law had been a plumber for years. He has three kids and a wife. And he really wanted to become a chef. And he decided at age, I think, 45, that he wanted to make this change. So he wanted to go to a culinary program.
Yeah.
So he asked me to guarantee a loan that he wanted to take out a loan of $30,000 for a 9-month program. And when I spoke with the job developers, I learned that he would be earning probably around $12 an hour after graduating. And I said, Frankie, if you take on this loan, you will have it over your head for the rest of your life. You have three kids you're trying to get through school and college. And, you know, I don't know what your prospects are long term, but this really sounds debilitating to me. And so we were able to find him. I was able to find him a program at a community college that has a beautiful laboratory or kitchen and facility for culinary arts. He was on the honor roll every semester. We were able to pay his tuition, which was $2,500 per term, and he has no debt, and now he's doing the job he wants, but he doesn't have that, he's not saddled with that debt. So I think so many people who don't have the information or people to help them kind of navigate the process really get bamboozled.
And where is the information on these different types of educational experiences? So, I mean, there are quite a few online sort of funnels for university courses, but I'm not sure if there are the equivalent for example, that course or other modular types of learning. Just wondered, you know, when you're trying to achieve your goal, how you get the message out about the sort of different types of education out there as well.
Yeah, I don't want to like single out any, but there are a few different nonprofit websites that do provide you, at least in the States, information about different kinds of programs and their costs. And they try to rank them and kind of help you match up your aspirations and needs with those programs.
And you've been at ASU GSV this week, obviously, with back-to-back meetings.
I have.
What's kind of been the main focus for you here? And also, what have you picked up in terms of useful information and trends and that kind of thing?
I'm heartened to see some new models for how to solve what have been identified as semi-intractable problems. So I've seen some new models for advising or, for example, students who've dropped out of school, ways of getting them back and re-enrolled that I think are win-win-win for the institution, the student, and the company. So I like those sorts of things. I've also seen some interesting mapping of the education technologies and how they're being applied to education globally.
Yeah.
And I like the landscaping stuff because I am, you know, investing in and looking for, you know, what are the best applications of virtual reality into courseware, or what are the best, you know, applications of predictive analytics into advising technologies or whatever it is. And so I like the landscape stuff. It helps me validate my own
landscape.
Is
that the Navitas? Yeah, it's pretty cool. And I think it was all drawn together through AI and then they've kind of clustered it all. So one question I always ask everyone is if there are any books, resources or people that have inspired you that you continue to go back to that perhaps help shape who you are. And they don't have to be in education or in tech, but things that you go back to that you think are quite formative for you.
Something, a book that is formative for my being, there are a couple. The Bhagavad Gita and there's a book called The Seat of the Soul that are personally formative for me. But in terms of the work that I'm doing now, one thing that's just like very top of mind right now is while I am rebuilding and adding to a team that I'm kind of trying to synthesize and tighten right now, I've been kind of reviewing a book called The Alliance by Reid Hoffman and Chris Hsieh a lot, which is about how to have the right of social contracts with your team members to make sure that everybody's getting their needs met.
Yeah.
As you work together. You know, there's a whole array of different stuff I'm constantly reading. The Tools of Titans, I really enjoy right now.
Yeah, so, I've got that at home and I haven't like.
You haven't cracked it yet?
Yeah. It's
there's quite, a lot there.
It's quite a monster, isn't it?
Tim is prolific with whatever he does. So
yeah. Yeah, he's probably quite responsible for me quitting my job and launching this podcast.
Is that right?
Okay. Whole 4-hour work week.
I loved that book. Yeah. I like to listen to his podcast quite a bit.
Yeah. And the work that you're doing, is that solely focused in the US or is it international? Or?
For now, I work in the US programs, which is exclusively now focused on early childhood development, K-12, and post-secondary success. We are having conversations with the global community just about, it would be my hope that they don't reinvent the same failures mm-hmm. we've learned, but can leapfrog a lot when going towards building more global solutions in education. So we try to have good dialogues with other folks within and outside of the foundation to make those linkages. But for now, our work at the foundation is really domestically focused.
Yeah. And so if people are listening in and they think they have something to offer, or if they're educational institutions that want to find out more about how they may be able to link in with the work that you're doing, what's the best way for them to contact you or contact what the foundation is doing as well?
The best thing is to go to the website. It's very, very detailed and has a lot of phenomenal information about everything that we do.
Yeah.
And so the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation website is hard to miss. And there's a lot there.
And are you a Twitter fan? Are you on Twitter or?
I am on Twitter, but I am not a high user.
Yeah.
The best way to kind of track me and my thinking is actually I'm a LinkedIn influencer.
Okay.
I'm an old school person. I prefer more long form.
Yeah.
And I don't like the immediate reactionary stuff. It's just, it's too much. And I can't organize and sort it out in the way that I need to. So I like to more proactively post out to my influencer site and then engage with people who reply.
And did you watch the CEO of LinkedIn speak?
Yeah, Jeff. Yeah. Yeah, no, he had some really interesting and inspiring words around how to practice compassion in the workplace. Mm-hmm. That's always been something that's very intriguing to me. So I was happy to hear him talk about
More empathy is what we want. Empathy or compassion. I know he distinguished between the two.
Yes, he did. Compassion is what he advocates for in the workplace.
So Heather, thank yes. you very much for your time and have a great rest of today as well.
Thank you, Sophie.
So I'm here with Hutton Higgins, who's Senior Director for Development and Strategic Alliances at the Barbara Bush Foundation for Family Literacy. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So Hutton, first question, can you tell us a little bit, you know, very top level, what the foundation is really about and what your kind of mission is as well?
Sure. So the Barbara Bush Foundation for Family Literacy was established a little over 25 years ago by Mrs. Bush herself. And the main focus of the foundation is Mrs. Bush's mission all along to make sure that we see literacy for all and really focus on the bookends of literacy, the young children and the adults, and bringing them together to solve many problems in this nation by helping them learn to read and write.
And since 25 years has passed, what kind of impact has the foundation had and you know, what's still to be done?
So we have established family literacy programs throughout the U.S. And honestly, we're trying to move the needle even more because there still are 36 million Americans that are not at the basic level of reading, which is just astounding. So our main focus right now is actually seeing this to scale, and we believe that we really can make a big impact through the XPRIZE, which is one of our big initiatives at the moment.
Yeah, so we were just talking about that. So I met Shomi and the team out at South by Southwest EDU, mm-hmm. and I was looking, you know, on the tech sort of innovation side of things there, if I understand it correctly, is around the smartphone app and right. what you're developing there. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well? So our XPRIZE is centered around an adult literacy learning app. So this was launched on Mrs. Bush's 90th birthday in 2015 and will end in 2019. Teams have been competing from around the world to develop an app, and they just completed this in December. And judges actually just selected the semifinalists, so the top 8 apps that will move on to the field tests this summer, which will take place in Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and Dallas.
Amazing. And
the field tests themselves, they're quite extensive, aren't they?
They are. You
know, it's not like a 6-week program.
No, no, it's a full year of field testing. And in each of these cities, we're recruiting between 3,500 to 5,000 adult learners. And those are adults that test below the third grade basic reading level based on the CASIS test.
And can you remember the 8 apps, or is that too much at 8:30 in the morning?
You know, honestly, we actually have been totally out of the judging.
Okay,
we have, there are expert judges out there, so we do not influence anything going on in the competition. I actually haven't even been able to see the apps yet, which I'm dying to see, because I've heard Shlomi was just blown away by what was submitted. So I am very excited to see them all in action.
Okay, great. This is kind of a retrospective question now, but I mean, what's the problem with literacy currently? So you mentioned the actual scale. What's wrong with the educational system as we have it that's not covering off literacy?
Sure. I mean, I think there are several organizations focused on K through 12. And then, you know, the adults are kind of forgotten sometimes. And, you know, there are family literacy programs out there. And unfortunately, there are large waiting lists for literacy programs. And also, you have to be able to get to these. So we would like to be able to serve people in rural areas that can't necessarily find their way to a program, or those that are on a wait list, and really be able to let them learn wherever they are at any time of the day.
So next question is Barbara Bush a tech phobe or a tech fan?
She loves tech. She has her own iPhone and she loves taking pictures on it. She sends emails. She's very up on tech and usually has 3 different Sony cameras. I mean, she has all the tech gadgets.
Yeah, that's good to hear. And in terms of your own role in joining the foundation, how did you get into the foundation and what were you doing previous to that as well?
So I actually served as Mrs. Bush's personal aide for 4 years, and so really got to know the foundation from working with Mrs. Bush, and would go visit some of our family literacy programs and really get to see it firsthand. And so through that, you know, I really got to know a lot about the foundation and moved over to work specifically planning her big 90th birthday event, which, you know, was a huge milestone for Mrs. Bush and for the foundation. So, and have continued on in our efforts ever since then.
And can you relay any stories from the birthday party? It must have been a huge effort to pull together.
It was. It was a 3-day event. And I would say Mrs. Bush is just one of the most humble people. She was blown away and surprised by how many people wanted to fly into Kennebunkport, Maine for her birthday, which of course everyone wanted to come. But she just was honestly, I think, blown away to see how much love was in one room.
So in terms of your particular role as well, so strategic alliances, if people are listening in and also work in sort of literacy programs or innovation of that sort, what would you say to them and how can they also get involved or kind of connect with you as well?
You can obviously visit our website, which is barbarabush.org. And there are ways to be involved with our XPRIZE as well. We have champions. We have different organizations signing up to amplify the message, to help with resources, whether that be help with recruiting or actual spaces in the field test cities. And then we also, after the field test phase, will have a communities competition throughout all of the US. So that will really be a chance for people to really get involved and be a part of that nationwide.
Oh, that's quite interesting. So once you've had the main competition, it will be a sort of a replica of that, but just to kind of create similar waves at a local level. Is that the idea?
So it is at the local level, and it actually, cities will be competing and they actually can win prize money. Whichever city can recruit and deploy the most apps in their city. So we're working with mayors, we're working with different community organizations. So obviously, there'll be a big competition to see what city can really make a big difference.
And do those apps have to be created within the US, or can they be external companies and developers that...
They can be outside the US. Yeah. In fact, we do have some that are in Canada, China. There were, I think, 15 different countries represented in the group that submitted apps to begin with. So...
And how about your time here at ASU GSV? What kind of meetings have you had and what have you picked up in terms of any trends that you've seen people either continue to talk about?
I mean, it's such a massive conference. I feel like there are so many great minds in one place and it's just really interesting to hear everyone's thoughts. And I would say everyone just wants to work together, whether it be traditional schools or charter schools. I feel like that's the message that's kind of been resonating with everyone. And then also, there's been some talk about social impact bonds and pay for success, which is a really interesting model that I think people are starting to explore.
Interesting. So can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because I know sort of at a very top level about social impact investing and, you know, obviously patient capital and that kind of thing, but I haven't heard about the particular description you just mentioned.
Honestly, I am not your person to get into the technicals of
social impact. We'll just do a financial report now.
Yes, we need a finance expert here.
Okay, cool. So no, we'll look that up though. But I think, yeah, this idea of impact and actually, you know, measuring outcome is now becoming something that many of the interviewees this week have picked up on as well. So that's wonderful. Thank you very much, Hutton. Have a great day and rest of your time at ASU GSV.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, that brings us to the end of this fifth episode from the 10-part ASU GSV Summit series. Don't forget to sign up to our newsletter to find out about our upcoming meetup drinks, cool jobs currently circulating, and other announcements. For full references, show notes, and book recommendations, go to theedtechpodcast.com. And for competitions and more, go to our Facebook page, www.facebook.com/podcastedtech. If you like what you hear, why not drop us a loving review on iTunes? And come back next time for our following episode on market mapping of the edtech sector. Have a great week.